Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and to give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-7099, Henry D.C. Water and Sewer Authority Petitioner. Ms. Ho for the petitioner, Mr. Hillary for the respondent.
Ms. Ho, good morning.
May it please the court, where litigants lack Article III standing, federal courts lack jurisdiction to adjudicate their claims. That fundamental principle underlies the general rule, undisputed here, that former employees lack Article III standing to seek injunctive relief in individual suits against a former employer. It is a violation of that constitutional rule and an abuse of the class action device.
Would you like to talk about the timeliness of your petition?
Certainly, Your Honor. We submit that our petition was timely filed within 10 days of the district court's order that denied our motion to clarify the class members for notice principles under the rule that order clarified a genuine ambiguity in the original class.
Didn't the court just deny the motion to clarify?
Yes, Your Honor, the court
did. So if it was ambiguous before the denial, it was ambiguous afterwards, was it?
Our submission is that it did respectfully resolve the question whether former employees...
All he said was the motion to clarify is denied.
Yes, Your Honor. We moved for a motion to clarify the class for notice purposes on the sole ground that it would violate Article III for former employees to be included in the class, and we sought clarity as to that specific proposition.
And he denied you your clarity. So if there was a question about it before your motion, there's still a question about it afterwards.
No, Your Honor, our submission respectfully is that that's not correct, because the only interpretation of the district court's order denying our motion to clarify the class members for notice purposes is that the former employees were included in the class. We brought the motion for purposes of being able to determine how to fulfill the district court's order in terms of providing actual notice to these employees, and it's simply impossible for us to supply the requisite notice with that uncertainty. So in denying our motion to clarify that former employees are not included in the class, the only reasonable
Who cares? Why does it matter?
Whether they're included in the class or not.
It matters.
I'll give you an analogy, which you're doubtless familiar with. We have multiple petitioners that come before us to seeking review of an agency decision. And we find that one of them has standing, which means that we don't have to bother with finding whether every one of them has standing. And there may be countless cases that we've adjudicated where we have 15 petitioners and only one of them has standing and 14 of them don't. Have we been violating Article III? I don't think so. So why is it that, who cares whether every single person in the class has standing or not?
Your Honor, our submission is that there is a distinction between the rule, which I believe Your Honor is referring to, and particularly in the class action context, that the plaintiff need not prove up or demonstrate the standing of every single unnamed class member for certification purposes. That's a very different proposition than the one advanced by Mr. Taylor here, which is that even though there are obvious jurisdictional Article III standing problems with unnamed class members, that means that the class can nonetheless
right.
include those members.
How many injunctions will issue?
Excuse me, Your Honor.
How many injunctions will issue?
As a result of
this case.
Well, that's yet to be determined.
One injunction.
Yes.
So whether you have 10 people that don't have standing and 50 that do or whatever, I mean, what?
Still one injunction.
Yes, Your Honor, but the Supreme Court made clear in Amchem that Rule 23 must be interpreted in light of Article 3 constraints. And the text of the three provisions under Rule 23B that must be satisfied for a class to be properly certified address both liability and redressability. And so here, as you say, what would issue would be an injunction. That's the only thing that the order, that the class has been certified.
Why would it matter? Your client looks at it and gets an injunction against whatever it was they were doing. And there are 50 people that are class members. They're all current employees. That's one scenario. The other is the same thing happens, and the people who are class members are 50 people who are current employees and one who left. Now, from your client's point of view, who cares? Why?
We care, Your Honor, because in the event of an adverse liability finding, as to liability.
You think back pay is equitable? Is that what's going on here?
No, Your Honor. As to a finding of liability, the absent class members who lack standing could certainly on appeal argue that they are not bound by that judgment. And that would create the very one-way intervention problem.
I'm wondering whether you have standing to even make this argument, because I can't see how it adversely affects you.
Well, Your Honor, I think it certainly adversely affects us to be defending in a class action where the class as certified does not satisfy Article 3 requirements, and that subjects us possibly to having a significant number of class members not bound because they lack standing by any judgment obtained as to liability.
Mm-hmm. And why couldn't you raise that issue on appeal from final judgment?
Your Honor, certainly with respect to standing, that issue could be raised at any time in the litigation and on final judgment. But we think the purposes that underlie Rule 23F, in particular in terms of resolving significant and unsettled issues such as this early in the litigation, weigh in our favor in terms of getting the standing issue resolved
now. But the standard under which this is all assuming that your petition is timely, and then it goes. Then the question is, should we exercise our discretion to hear it? And you're arguing that this is an important and unsettled issue, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
But that standard for exercising our jurisdiction to hear a case like this also requires not just that it be an important and unsettled question, but that it, quote, is likely to evade end of case review. That's a quote from this Lorazepam case that you're relying on, likely to evade end of case review. And you don't even say in your brief that, you don't even argue that point.
Your Honor, respectfully, we don't think we need to meet in all circumstances that requirement. This court,
why is that?
This court in the Lindsay case, mm-hmm. Did reach an issue of supplemental jurisdiction that certainly would have been amenable to review it at final judgment, and it did so on the principle that because subject matter jurisdiction is a prerequisite to class certification, that it was appropriate to address issues involving the court's subject matter jurisdiction.
Well, what do we do with this language in Lorazepam? That's what you're relying on. I mean, you're relying on this case. And it's very clear that it has to be both material and unsettled and evade end of case review.
Well, Your Honor, I think, although we don't argue the point in our brief, I think it certainly could be considered likely to evade review, certainly in the sense that the standing issue would likely, I suppose that's assuming that the case goes to trial, proceeds to a final judgment that's subject to appeal, and does not settle. And so I think that this court also said it in Rey-Lorazepam that those guidelines were not set in stone, but that merely provided guidelines that this court could use. And we submit that this is a case in which the importance of the subject matter jurisdiction and the Article III standing question presented merits this court's review under Rule 23F. And I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for
Can I just ask you one question?
And yes, Your Honor.
I'll give you a minute. Let's see, I can't remember the chronology, but I know there was at least a year between Judge Kennedy's order and the motion to clarify. But so that's late, but you also had filed a motion for reconsideration soon after that order and didn't include this as a one of the issues.
Yes, Your Honor, that's...
Were you just not focused on the notice or what?
That's correct, no. And in part, that was because the district court expressly declined to certify the class for damages, and particularly in light of the fact that the former employees would only have standing to seek damages. For that reason, and in our view that the class had been had been certified solely for injunctive or declaratory relief, we didn't seem reasonable to us that the order would embrace former employees. So it was in the process of once the court in March issued its notice order, and we filed our motion to clarify shortly after that.
All right. Okay.
Thank you,
Mr. Hillary.
Good morning, Your Honors. The first point that the plaintiff below would like to make is that the defendant's Rule 23F petition is untimely. The petition was filed more than a year after the court's class certification decision. Excuse me. 23F requires that the petition be filed within 10 days after the order granting or denying certification is entered. The order granting and denying class certification was issued March 13, 2007. The order denying WASA's motion for reconsideration was issued September 13, 2007. Therefore, the deadline for WASA's Rule 23F petition was September 27, 2007. The petition was not filed until August 7, 2008, which is almost 17 months after the initial order granting and denying class certification, almost 11 months after the order denying the motion for consideration, and more than 10 months after the deadline under Rule 23F. The deadline under Rule 23F is strict and mandatory. Now, WASA has argued that the district court's order on their motion for clarification restarted the 10-day deadline under Rule 23F. Now, clearly, all the district court did with respect to their motion for reconsideration was to state that it denied the motion. That did not in any way disturb the status quo. It did not clarify any alleged ambiguity, which we argued there was no ambiguity in the first place. Now, if this court allows a 23F petitioner to go back to the district court that long after the order granting class certification on the basis of a manufactured pretense, that being the motion for clarification, and on that basis reopen the 10-day window under Rule 23F, then you've basically eviscerated the 10-day rule under Rule 23F.
Suppose the district court had actually, instead of just saying motion denied, had said, had issued an order actually clarifying that employees, former employees, were not part of the class. Would that have started the clock again?
I think it would.
Okay.
Because at least arguably that would have altered the status quo, right. At least arguably.
Yeah.
But here, the district court basically didn't say anything other than your motion is denied. If Wass's argument is that the district court's order was ambiguous, motion denied does not clarify that ambiguity. So if it was ambiguous in the first instance, it's ambiguous now. But the fact is that there was no change in the status quo. The 10-day clock did not restart on the basis of that order, and Wass's motion is far untimely.
Has this appeal in any way slowed down the proceedings in the district court?
Well, to the extent that the plaintiffs below's attorneys have had to now fight on two fronts as opposed to one, to that extent it has. Now, the district court did not issue a stay.
We're not supposed to, right?
I'm sorry?
These appeals are not supposed to stop the proceedings in the lower court.
Not in the absence of a stay granted either by the district court or by your honors. And there has been no stay granted. Nonetheless, that has forced plaintiff's counsel to now litigate in two courts as opposed to one. Mm. So almost necessarily that has an impact on the forward-going nature of the district court proceeding.
Do you know how many people we're talking about here?
I have no idea, Your Honor. And one point that we made in our brief was that at no point has WASA stated what proportion of the putative class consists of former WASA employees.
They would know because they're the ones that have to give notice, right?
Yes. Well, they have that information.
Yeah.
We don't know. Okay. So we don't know if we're talking about 100 people, if we're talking about 20 people, if we're talking about 200 people. We have no idea.
How about none?
Well, it's theoretically possible that it's none, but yeah, given the fact of WASA and its employee makeup, I doubt that it's not. But the point I'm making is that nobody knows. And we argue that it's interesting that WASA wants to claim that this is of such monumental importance, and it has to be not only generally but also in this case, but they haven't stated at all what proportion of the putative class would be affected by what they seek from this court.
If any.
I'm sorry?
It's entirely possible if the district judge itches an injunction requiring certain workplace activities to be done in a particular way. How does that affect somebody who retired 10 years ago?
It doesn't.
I know. Yeah.
Okay. Now, we argue that the general rule is that if one named plaintiff has standing to seek relief, then the entire class has that standing. And we would cite to Lewis versus Casey, 518 U.S. 343 at 357 to 358, and also at 394 to 395, which is the dissent in that case. We would cite to Blum, B-L-U-M, versus Yaretsky, Y-A-R-E-T-S-K-Y, 457 U.S. 991, 1000 to 1001, and note 13, that's 1982. We would cite to Bates versus United Parcel Service, 511 F3rd, 974 at 985, that's Ninth Circuit, December 28th, 2007, which is a case that's subsequent to the Dukes versus Walmart case that WASA has relied on extensively. Now, in light of the fact that if one named...
Let me understand. So what you're saying, counsel, is that as far as standing to seek injunctive relief, as long as one class member, there's no doubt that the lead class member has standing, the case can go forward in the Supreme Court that has so said. It may be that people who are ultimately become members of the class lack standing. They can be excluded at some point, but not at this stage. Only after we know who they are, how can we exclude them, and after final judgment. Is that
Well, I'm not saying that if any member of the class has standing, then the class has standing. I'm saying that the authorities that we cite stand for the proposition that if a named class member has standing, then the class has standing to seek that relief that the named class member has standing to seek.
Here's my own question is this. It's not a question of the way I'm taking your argument is not a question of whether somebody who has no standing can be a member of this class. The question is when you make that decision, I thought. You're not maintaining that somebody has no standing. After when you get the final judgment, you have a list of all the class members that you can't just strike them off. I mean, they have no interest in this case.
I'm really not sure that I understand your question, Your Honor. I apologize. Maybe I can get at it this way.
Here's the final judgment. We've got, just hypothetically, we've got 21 people that are class members. They've been notified, and we've gotten their forms back, and, this, that, and the other. So we have 21 people, and judge issues final judgment. It turns out that one of them hasn't worked at the company for 10 years. And there's a motion to strike that person from the class. Would you oppose it?
Well, at this point, Your Honor, the
class. No, not at this point, at final judgment.
At final judgment with respect to this phase of the litigation?
No, the whole case is over, right. Yeah.
I mean, if it was clear that the class member, the putative class member, lacked Article III standing to entitle him to the relief that was sought.
Yeah, right.
No, I don't think we would oppose that.
Yeah.
Because they have no entitlement to that relief.
And they wouldn't care either.
Not if we're talking about injunctive relief. If we're talking about monetary relief.
Monetary relief is a different story entirely. Okay.
You say, set aside the question of timeliness for just a minute, okay? You say this, that the district court's order is clear and that prior employees are included in the class, right?
Yes.
But he defined the class as, quote, black employees at WASA, right?
Yes.
And that's the definition of the class.
Between.
Black employees at WASA. So couldn't you easily interpret that to mean that what he meant was black employees at WASA now?
He doesn't say black employees at WASA now.
No, that's what I'm just saying. It's ambiguous. You say it's clear. I'm just asking you why you think it's clear.
Well,
looks to me like it's ambiguous.
Well, because he says black employees at WASA from October 96 to December 2000.
Yeah, I think that the rest of the sentence is, you need to look at the entire sentence to see whether it's clear or not. But I would also point out to your honors, if you look at the way WASA has behaved, it seems to indicate that there was no ambiguity to WASA either,
right?
Because the order that granted and denied was March 13, 2007, and that order said that class members should be notified.
Yeah.
It said right there. Now, WASA's argument is they didn't see that this was ambiguous until the court ordered them to actually notify the class members. If the order was so ambiguous, it should have been apparent first when the order was issued, secondly, by the time they did their motion for reconsideration. The fact that WASA didn't think it was ambiguous or didn't challenge it as ambiguous until well after a year after the order was issued, I would argue indicates that the order was not ambiguous. Now, certainly, ambiguity, Your Honors, it is difficult to say anything or write anything that is entirely zero with respect to ambiguity. Statutes are drafted, opinions are read and written, and certainly it's Your Honor's experience and your job. You see ambiguity all the time. So I'm not saying that there was zero ambiguity with respect to the district court's order. I'm saying that on its face, the district court's order was clear. Not that it couldn't be misinterpreted, not that there was zero ambiguity, but that it was clear. And if the order was in fact ambiguous, it would not have taken WASA and its attorneys a year and a half to determine that it was ambiguous.
You said something I wanted to ask you about. So Judge Kennedy ordered, when did Judge Kennedy order the notification, and was it by a separate order? I mean, what was the lag time between any order that he said to WASA, okay, now notify, and they said, oh, wait, now we've discovered we don't know, or we don't think former employees
are included. The
original
order granting and denying the motion for class certification was March 13, 2007.
Right.
The actual order directing that notice be sent to the class members was March 3rd, 2008, so almost a year later.
So it took a year for the judge to issue the order to notify the class? What was going?
There was a motion for reconsideration.
Right, right.
Then there was the motion, well, I'm not sure when if the motion to clarify fell into that window or not. But yes, there was approximately a year.
So from March of 2008 until August of 2008 is still a long time to realize or to try to get clarification on how we're supposed to notify someone.
I would say
this case has really moved very slowly. I'm just throwing that out.
That's true.
All right, your time is up.
May I ask a question?
Okay.
Have you sought back pay on behalf of the class members?
In the complaint?
Yeah.
Yes, I believe so, yes.
Okay. Suppose that back pay is considered an equitable remedy so that it comes within the heading of injunctive relief. Then there would be no that then former employees would have standing, wouldn't they?
Yes.
Yeah. There's an opinion of this court saying that, well, actually there's an in-bank opinion of the court in a case called Hubbard back in the 90s saying back, I think it said back pay is not an equitable remedy, but I'm really not sure, but there's another opinion in 1997 in Eubanks versus Billington, which is 110 Fed 3rd 87, that says back pay is an equitable remedy.
Okay. Well, I'm not aware of that opinion.
I mean, either if that's the case, then then I think the defendant ought to address that issue, because that means that the individuals, it's, you know, on by your submission, who are no longer employed, do have standing. They have standing to seek back pay as an equitable remedy.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Ho, we'll give you a minute.
What about that?
As an initial matter, the class was certified solely for injunctive and declaratory relief. It was not certified for back pay.
But back pay is considered part of injunctive relief under the Eubanks case.
I don't believe the district court considered the issue of back pay. In fact, the district court expressly declined to certify the class for damages.
See, that's the issue. The issue is whether back pay is considered damages or whether back pay is considered an equitable remedy.
Yes, but I think in terms of the prior issue, in terms of whether the former employees are even included for notice purposes in the class is certainly something that we would need resolved. And certainly we would appreciate this court's direction to the lower court, even in a denial of our motion, in terms of getting clarity on that issue, simply because we have to know who to give notice to. May I
go ahead?
Address Judge Randolph, I also wanted to address your question briefly about the number of individuals that we're talking about. It is not in the record, but my understanding is that the figure is in the neighborhood of 150 persons that are in that.
Are there former employees? 150?
That's correct. 150 former employees that would be at issue.
How many current are covered?
Roughly, the class is certified, as the district court said, about 800.
Okay.
And we further understand that about 300 to 400 people who were employees when the complaint was filed back in 2001 are no longer employees.
So if it's not back pay and it's just a single injunction that we're talking about, you still have the kind of making the I'm answering a question I ask you, which is you still have an interest, because why should we have to go through all the trouble of notifying and mailing and all that, 150 people who have no connection with this case at all? We shouldn't have to go through that administrative expense and so on, right?
Yeah. Yes, Your Honor. That's
Okay. I didn't realize it was that many people.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.